Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. It's very natural for us as human beings to have that the feeling of wouldn't it be nice if I didn't have so much difficulty to contend with? You know, all of us in our own ways. Whether we're a woman or a man, a monastic or layperson, old or young, whatever particular sets of experiences and conditions that we live with, it's very natural for us to feel, oh, things would be so much better if I didn't have this illness to deal with, if I was a little bit older, if I was a bit younger, if I didn't have these things I was being asked to do that I feel out of my control, or I'm being asked to do things that are beyond my ability. If only I had, if I was a bit more clever, if only I was a little less clever, a little taller, a little shorter. If only there wasn't this difficulty, if only I didn't have this crazy person in my family that it's become my responsibility to look after, if only there wasn't this conflict in my community, if only I was a little bit more senior, if I was a bit more junior. This is very natural for us, isn't it? Each of us can take our own lives, our own particular sets of experience, and fill in the blanks. What the mind picks up and says, "Oh, if only I didn't have to deal with this, yeah, life would be great. Wouldn't it be so much better if I didn't have to have this personality or this obstruction, this difficulty, these." Uncomfortable habits or fears and attributes, this difficult person I have to live with, to share my time with. If only I was at a different monastery. Well, this is very natural for us, very ordinary. And that often those kind of attitudes take shape and form within us completely unconsciously, and we can create this sort of image of what life would be like without this particular problem, without this particular issue. A friend of ours in America, who have a Zen monastery up in Oregon called Great Vow Zen Monastery. Within their community, they call this the other monastery syndrome. Yeah. At the other monastery, they do things really well. At the other monastery, everything is really great. At the other monastery, they have real communal harmony. At other the other monastery, then they practice really strictly and properly. Not like us. Not like this imperfect place with these inadequate people, these unideal conditions. And so, naming it as the other monastery, it's a skillful way of saying, look how the grass is always greener. Years ago, I saw a cartoon I like to quote, to refer to every so often. And in this particular cartoon, it's referring to this this. Habit of say looking for the greener grass, and it's a picture of a corner of four different fields. So you have two wire fences that cross. So you have a corner where four different fields all meet at one spot. And in each field there's a cow. And each cow is standing in the one field and it has its head through the fence and is eating the grass on the other side. So all the cows are in a neat little square, if you can imagine the picture. They're all in a neat little square and each one has got its head through the fence eating the grass on the other side. So we, if you can imagine that, you can see how, oh, we see it as a cartoon and we go, oh, ha, 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 ha. But it's pointing to what we do, isn't it? That just over there, if things were a bit different, if I just didn't have this particular problem on my plate, then you know, life would be so much easier, so much better. Or like in the Wizard of Oz, at the very beginning of the Wizard of Oz, those of you who are familiar with that that film, that story, where a young Dorothy whose dog Toto is being threatened with extinction by the evil neighbor. Difficulty and oppression she's experiencing, and she wonders, wouldn't it be nice, wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a place where there was no trouble? That's the cue for the song, Over the Rainbow. Somewhere over the rainbow, that's the place where there is no trouble, no difficulty. Everything is really fine all of the time. Well, we highlight that as a fantasy or as a vain dream, because in reality there is no such place. You know, that is in a way an idealized picture or a hope or a dream based on a reality that doesn't exist. That wherever we go, there's always going to be something. There's always, whatever station in life, whatever age we are, whatever the state of our health or our living situation in the family, in the community, in our workplace, there's always going to be something. That's the way it is. And that rather than thinking of these the elements of our lives that seem to be the thing that's getting in the way, the thing that's obstructing our happiness, we can change the attitude towards that. And it's not just because you had an unlucky break or that other people have got it really good and you've missed out on all of the good fortune. I would suggest, if we look at life, we just examine the way things are. It's the same for everybody, everywhere. There's always something or several things in our life that have that characteristic of being irritating or difficult or obstructive, burdensome to the heart. So what's the best way to relate to those aspects of our experience? One time somebody came to visit Ajahn Chah, and was the usual scene at Wat Pa Phong and Ajahn Chah's monastery was he would and there's a large open area underneath his kuti, underneath the hut where he stayed, and that was where he would receive visitors, and there was an open area under the kuti, and then he'd sit on a wicker bench there, and then people would come and talk with him, ask questions, and there'd be that was the main area for him to see people and to give teachings for much of the day, every day. And one time this person came along and they spent time sitting there with Lumpo, and considerable time went by, 2 or 3 hours, and they saw, you know, that all these different people, the monks and nuns, would come and ask questions, or different groups of lay people would come, have different issues about their family life or their work or in the meditation questions, all sorts of different things. And after 2 or 3 hours of this, this visitor said to Lumpur, "Yeah, Lumpur, it's really amazing. You know, you're so wise. It's, no matter what people ask you about, whether it's how to look after a crazy brother, or how they can deal with the rice harvest not flourishing, whether they can deal with their obstructions in their mindfulness of breathing practice, or conflict in between the monks. Everything you seem to have an answer for. It's incredible. It's amazing. You must have studied the suttas so deeply. You must have really spent an enormous time absorbing Abhidhamma to understand the teachings so completely, and to always be able to answer people in a way that's effective, that's appropriate, that's so helpful. And the way they were talking was implying that Lumpur was incredibly well studied, had read all the books and all the commentaries, or was just amazingly pure and wise from early childhood. And he, to their surprise, he said, "Well, it's not that I've read that much of the suttas, and I certainly haven't spent much time with the Abhidhamma." And he said, "If I have developed any wisdom, it's because I've had such enormous defilements that my difficulties and problems in life were the things that have taught me." And so the person was quite taken aback. He said, "Yeah, it's true that it's through dealing with the manifold difficulties of life that's what really helps you to cultivate genuine wisdom. That's what helps you to grow up, to be wise, and to learn to understand people and what's going to be useful. Because just studying the books or memorizing the Abhidhamma says this doesn't help you to in a direct and complete way to deal with say anger." It says, "I can learn about anger in the book. I can study the psychological components of it, but that's not the same as that feeling of red hot rage in the heart, is it?" So the person was a bit taken aback, but it was a very wise and true answer also. And for when we read Ajahn Chah's teachings, or we listen to them, to his words, then you can get a feeling of what an incredibly wise and insightful, observant person. And you can get that impression, or make that assumption, that he was that wise or that clever, that astute from the get-go. But it's important to take that to heart, what he says, that the reason why he developed any wisdom was because of his enormous defilements. And of the major hindrances that are there in the usual list, Ajahn Chah had enormous lust. He was extremely lustful. He had very, very short temper. He could get very angry, very prone towards being judgmental and full of aversion. He had a very powerful doubting mind. That was the greatest of his teachers, or the greatest of his problems, he often said, was that of doubt. And he was very restless. It was very difficult for him to stay in one place and just stay there. But he was always wanting to be on the move. So of the five hindrances, the only one he really missed out on was dullness. And I think it's because the other four were also volcanic, hyperactive, that he didn't have time to be dull because everything else was cooking so strongly. So this is important for us to consider, that the things that we can think of as being obstructions or difficulties, the habits of the mind towards fear or desire or aversion, restlessness, dullness, rather than these being sort of unfortunate problems that we would be better off without, if we it could be, obviously in one sense we can, it's natural reasonable to see them in that way. But if we shift the attitude and instead look at these as, say, aspects of our life that we can learn important lessons from, then it changes the picture, doesn't it? And it's not just internal qualities. We can also look at having to learn how to live with a sibling who is unstable, or crazy, or very dependent, or personality clashes in the community, or professional jealousy in the workplace, the struggles between parents and children and parents in the home, struggles within the monastic community. We can shift the attitude towards those external issues or internal issues, and rather look at these as things that can be our teachers, things that give us a genuine opportunity to learn, to grow up. As Shakespeare put it in one of his plays, "Sweet are the uses of adversity." Sweet are the uses of adversity, meaning adversity being difficulty or obstruction, problems. He said, there are many sweet uses, many good ways that we can put this to use. And in that line comes in a play called As You Like It, when a noble and good duke has been banished to go and live in the forest. His evil brother has taken over the power and sent the good duke to go off and live in the forest. And so there they are. This nobleman has been bereft of his wealth and his living place, and he's off living in the woods with a few friends. And he says, basically, "Well, this is great. This is really nice living in the forest. Don't have to go to all those miserable meetings and have to deal with all that stuff. And you can listen to the music of the voices of the trees and the water in the stream and hear the sermons given by the rocks and the leaves. So this is great." How sweet are the uses of adversity. So when we change the attitude like that, rather than looking at, say, our kilesas, the defilements that we experience as an unfortunate imposition or something that's intrinsically burdensome, we can turn the attitude. We can shift the attitude to see that this is an opportunity. And what can we learn from that? How can we turn those obstructions or difficulties to our advantage? When you're asked to do some job that you think, "This is impossible, I can't do this, I'm completely out of my depth here." Why do they ask me to take care of this when it's beyond my capacity? Or how come I'm the one who always has to unravel all these tangles that other people make? You know, harumph. reasonable complaints about things that we're asked to do, or personality clashes, or struggles and difficulties in the family, in the community, or wherever. To say, "Aha, look at that. This is something I would really choose to not have to deal with. Aha." So, what is there to learn from this? How can I learn from this? What's going on in me in relationship to this particular issue, this particular experience? What can I learn from this habit of always feeling worried and afraid, or this habit of complaining, criticizing, blaming? What can I do what can I learn from this habit of always wanting, always needing to get and to own, to have? Over the classical five hindrances, the qualities that they are taken to be hindering or obstructing samadhi. This is the five hindrances, this little group. What they're hindering, what they're obstructing, is classically is the quality of samadhi, of mental collectedness, of the capacity to focus the mind. So if you see that the mind is very drawn towards aversion, negativity, always criticizing, complaining, blaming, the mind adverts, goes towards negativity, then the recommendation is to counteract, to work with that by developing loving kindness, metta bhavana. So if you see that's a tendency of the mind towards negativity, then what we can learn from that is how to be kind, how to cultivate an attitude of benevolence as opposed to complaining. even though it might be very tempting, you might have a very strong habit. One of the younger monks at Abhayagiri Monastery, when he was an Anagarika, he used to do a lot of driving, so he and I spent a lot of hours in the monastery van together, going up and down the highway between Abhayagiri Monastery and San Francisco, which is about 2.5 hours drive away. So we spent many, many hours on the road and many journeys here and there together. And his mind he was a world-class complainer. That would be the first, when any particular issue or any experience that the mind would just go towards reasonable complaints, well-founded and well-justified criticisms, but that's where his mind would always go. But I remember one time we were traveling down to San Francisco, and he was going on and on and on about some particular issue and how this was wrong with this monk and that was wrong with the other monk, and if only the routine was different, or if you didn't have to deal with this particular ailment, and then everything would be fine. And so I said, of all the different forms of spiritual practice, you have the way of Zen, or the Zen of cookery, and or the way of spiritual practice based on handicrafts, or of mountain climbing, or of, along with meditation and motorcycle maintenance. I said, they've never actually published a book on the Zen of complaining. The complaining has never been established as the way towards Nirvana. And he said, well, I could develop a niche. I'm sure there's an opportunity there. But he hasn't gone into print yet that I know of. So even though it can be a well-worn track, to see that, even though we can have good reason, just to see, look at that, the mind keeps going towards negativity, towards blaming, complaining, seeing the source of my suffering is you, or is the world, there is this issue. And instead, to counteract that negativity, the way of complaining, to cultivate instead the quality of metta. And in this respect, as is often said, when we talk about metta, it doesn't mean to say we're trying to like everything. If you have a debilitating illness, or you have a tense relationship with your parents, or you have some kind of painful loss, a deep grief from some loss in your life, or some regret over an unskillful action that you've carried out, then having metta doesn't mean that we're trying to like those bitter experiences, those painful qualities. When you have say chronic headaches, or migraines, or a physical difficulties, emotional pain that is there, we're not trying to pretend that we like it, or make ourselves like the unlikable. But as Lungpo Sumedho said over and over again over the years, we're not trying to make ourselves like the unlikable. But what we can recognize is that we can accept those qualities as being part of the natural order, that they belong, that the bitterness is part of life. Bitterness has its place in nature. And so that rather than trying to regard metta as making ourselves like things, more it's to be able to accept. So a metta is rather a radical acceptance, to recognize that even the unlikable, we don't have to hate. That we can be patient with that, we can be accepting, without any kind of hypocrisy, without trying to sugar things over. And he would use, Lumpur Sumedho would use the term not dwelling in aversion as a way of rendering metta. And I find that far more helpful, to not dwell in aversion, to find that quality of radical acceptance, that even though this grief in the heart or this deep regret about your conduct or this physical pain, it's not something that you can like or say, oh, how marvelous, you know, another headache, great. How wonderful. You're not trying to sugar things over or pretend that the sweet is what you're experiencing when the feeling is bitter. But more recognizing this is the way bitterness is. This is what grief feels like. This is the experience of being baked by the sun or frozen by the cold wind. It's like this. It has this quality, and this too is part of nature. So there's a radical acceptance within the heart that this experience, this feeling belongs. It's not out of order. And in that acceptance, you're not, ignoring the reality of it, but you're not developing negativity in relationship to it either. There's a simple and genuine openness to it. So this, when we're talking about developing metta as a counterpoint or as a balancing for aversion, it's not just trying to think positively or sweeten everything up, but finding that place in the heart where everything belongs. Cruelty belongs. Loss and failure, they belong. These are experiences that are part of the natural order. We're not inflating them or trying to glamorize them, but recognizing this is part of the whole picture. So then that counteracting the habits of negativity, aversion, when we see that complaining, criticizing, blaming, resenting attitude arising, just to notice that, to feel that that sharpness, that negativity, and to know, you know, what that is, to say, oh yeah, this is something that the mind can feel. This is a capacity that we have. And seeing that if we dwell on that, if we buy into it, if we believe in that that blaming, that complaining, that criticizing, then we only harm ourselves as well as harming and alienating others. And that in that very act of seeing, that very shift of attitude towards acceptance of that quality, then there's a brightening, there's a lightening of the heart. So this is what the Buddha encouraged in relationship to dealing with aversion, with biyapada, ill will. You counteract that with loving kindness. The other side of that, the hindrance of karma raga or sense desire, then the Buddha encouraged the attitude or the practice of asupa kamatana, or the reflection on the unbeautiful, the unattractive. So this is when the mind is in the opposite way, is drawn towards acquisition, getting, having, owning, possessing. And you know, classically, this is directed at sexual desire, the desire for other people that are physically appealing, and so that the usual practices around asupa kamatana, and reflections on the unbeautiful, are to do with, say, breaking the illusion of the attractiveness of a human body. And just as say at the ordination ceremony, then we reflect on the constituents of the external form of us as human beings: hair of the head, hair of the hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. And just listing that, you know, just making a list of five different attributes, it right there, it somewhat deglamorizes it. Just you think, well, that, you know, that's the extent of the external form, the way that our body appears in the world, that we appear in the world. That's all it is: hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. That's the external attributes, and then you add on a few accessories like your clothing and jewelry and hair dye, a bit of makeup. But fundamentally, this is the external form. That's all it consists of: hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. How remarkable, how amazing that we can spend so much effort, be so bedazzled or bewitched, confused by the configurations of just those things: hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. Sometimes you see them when you go through a town. You know, sometimes see them all together in a line of shops. You have the hair, you know, you have the hairdressers, and then the nail parlor, the tanning salon, maybe the dentist next door to them as well. Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. That's it. Just attending to the external forms and the way that the body is presented as apparent in the world. So to reflect on the constituent elements of the body, or in other aspects of those reflections, when you find yourself drawn or tantalized, you know, attracted by the external appearance of somebody, and that the eye is caught by someone's form, and the attention is grabbed, then also the Buddha suggested the simple practice of recollecting what's below the skin, you know, what it's like on the inside. And so when the mind is sort of drawn towards some external attribute, like, wow, you know, look at those eyes, look at that, you know, look at those muscles, look at that beautiful form, then to just take it a step further, to develop this perception, like, wow, I wonder what the pancreas is like. Think about the liver. Whoa, you know, what a great pair of lungs! You know, as soon as you start to think in those ways, like, you know, that, then it's you can almost hear the internal voice say, "Oh, shut up! You're ruining the whole thing. you're spoiling the illusion." But this is the Buddha's teaching, and the advice of our teachers. It points to the effectiveness of just taking that illusion apart a little bit, just to say dismantling the fabric of that presentation, and just seeing, well, what's really here? When we desire a human form, do we really desire the bone marrow? You know, is the synovial fluid really that appealing? You know, the goop in the bottom of our lungs, is that really so fantastically tantalizing? It's like, but even as I say this, and the mind, oh, shut up. You're spoiling the whole thing. But what is it that is being annoyed or frustrated or irritated by that, by the illusion being spoiled? That's what wants to believe in that perception, that the habits of kamaraga that are being frustrated or kind of being denied their object, they're denied their food. So simply by using the reflective power of the mind to unpick the illusion in a way to see how the conjurer does the trick, then it takes away that particular fascination, that particular compulsion that arises with sexual desire. But also, the desire mind doesn't just relate to physical attraction towards others. And some of you might be thinking, "Well, pah, you know, that's no problem for me. Sexual desire hasn't been any kind of issue for me for years." But then we also can find ourselves filled with desire for other kinds of objects, that maybe material possessions that you don't really care about a physical attraction, but you know you go all gooey over looking at the latest computer catalog, like desiring the latest upgrade for your iPhone or or the latest brand of meditation cushion or the opportunities to go and visit the next compelling guru who promises total enlightenment and ultimate spiritual happiness to go and be with that particular wise and wonderful person. So desire objects take all sorts of different forms. It can be food, it can be meditation states, desire to go on a particular retreat, maneuvering to get to the front, to get the front cushions on the retreat so you can be right in the right in front of the teacher to get the full shakti, get the full blast of the great Ajahn's aura. Like, we might think ourselves terribly spiritual and pure, but then someone moves your cushion or they get to the front center place that you were after, then we can experience a rage of frustration. So sense desire is not just those kind of raw sexual feelings, but it can locate itself in all sorts of ways, depending on our own particular sets of conditioning. But in the same way that we can use that form of, in a way, analytical, reflective thinking to say, well, what is it that's so promising? If I really did get that object, if I did get the upgrade to the computer, if I did acquire if I did get to sit in front of the teacher the whole time, I did acquire that particular thing, have that wonderful taste, that food experience, or get to be with that person, does that mean I will be permanently and absolutely happy? And what we're doing with this, in a sense, is looking at the whole story. And the Buddha, in the Buddha's teaching, he talked about the asada, which is the gratification, but also the adinava, any kind of sense experience, or particularly in relationship to sense desire. There's the asada, the gratification. There's the yes. When we have that contact, we see that attractive person, we're in contact with them, or we get that new application for the iPhone, or you get the desired seat in the meditation hall, or you get to be with the situation or the person, you get the promotion, or you get the marriage, or you get the divorce, or you have the child, or you see the child off to university, and at last, free at last, I've got it, at last here we are. Then the adinava, so that the Buddha recognizes, there's the asada, there's the gratification, there's the yes, got it, hooray, fantastic, this is what I was after. And then there's the adinava, which is the bill, which is the what goes along with the package when we get what we want. Then there's living with what we've got, having then to take care of it, the feeling of ownership, the sense of fear that beautiful, precious thing that we've got is now gonna degenerate, or it's gonna leave us, or we're gonna have to lock it up and keep it safe. We're gonna have to protect our space, the thing that we've got. So the adinava is the downside, the liability, the shadow, if you like, of the things that we get. So that reflecting on kamaraga, how to counteract sense desire, it's using this capacity to see, to recognize and acknowledge the asada. Yes, there's the gratification, there's the wow, look at that, what a camera. Wow, this is a great situation. Oh, this is what I wanted. The perfect place. This is the other monastery. At last. This is what I wanted. To acknowledge that gratification, but to see that its partner, the inseparable partner, is the adinava, is the downside. And then along with the asada and adinava, then the last bit, or the most important bit, is the nisarana, the escape, which is that basically the insight into this can't possibly satisfy. It never could. So that was the chemistry of it all along, that this is impermanent. It's unsatisfactory. It's not self. It's anicca, dukkha, anatta. That's the escape, or the escape hatch, is that very insight, seeing that, you know, all that arises passes away, that no thing can possibly satisfy forever. No thing can be kept. No thing is a self or belongs to a self. That's the part of that whole expression of experience that is really the liberating factor. So when we talk about dealing with sense desire, it's helpful to see that what we're doing is cultivating that reflective ability, that in a way that analyzing the chemistry of desire and seeing in our life, really examining what are the things that we want, what are the things that we feel that we own, what is the value system that we are most born into. And you think, well, I've got a problem with cameras or sexual desire or food. But then say, well, take a look and see, where are the things that we value? What are the things that we really want? What are the things that we dread are going to be taken away from us? Where are they? What are they? And for each one of us, that's going to be different. But if we take a look and we see, oh, look at that. That's what I really want. That's what those are the desire objects in my particular universe. Aha. So then bringing that quality of reflective wisdom, analysis, analytical reflection, dhammavicaya, investigation of reality, bringing that capacity of dhammavicaya, yoniso manasikara, investigation, to bear on that. And then as we deconstruct the value system, we deconstruct the illusion that the conjurer of avijja, of ignorance, that that makes within the mind, that says, this is really precious, this is really yours, now you've got it, and this will really make you happy. It's taking that conjuring trick apart and saying, well, yes and no. there'll be a thrill, there'll be a happiness, there's a gratification, but with that, there's the danger, the liability, the ardhinava. And the escape is to recognize how that works, how the trick works, and then we teach ourselves how not to be drawn in to the same illusion, not to be drawn into compulsion by that same illusion in the future. And for the other hindrances, restlessness, udaccha kukuccha, which the very word makes you feel itchy, udaccha kukuccha, you feel like you immediately need to change your posture, just hearing the word udaccha kukuccha. That is gives us the opportunity to learn patience. So sense desire helps us to be, in a way, cool, and to cultivate the capacity to reflect and to see clearly. Ill will encourages the capacity to be kind, to be accepting. Restlessness helps us to cultivate patience, that which is ready to bear with the difficult or the burdensome. And one of the things with the quality of patience is difficult to bring across is that the Buddhist concept of patience, or also of renunciation, these don't really have an entirely comparable representation in the English language, because to be patient, the word patience in English means that you're sort of gritting your teeth, you're waiting for the unpleasant thing to be over, but you're sort of being strong and firming yourself up and and you know, have the capacity, the strength to grit your teeth and to bear it. But that is not really the same as the quality of Kanti Paramita. This is the paramitas literally mean the qualities that help to carry the heart across to the other shore, that which carries us across. And so patience, which is a paramita, is really a radiant quality. It's a brightness of the heart. It's not just a clamping down and gritting of the teeth. It's not just a grim a grim resolution. So the patience in its essence, in its purity, is a letting go of time in the Buddhist perception of things. It's a letting go of things being any other way than they are right now. It's not just waiting, being very strong and fixed and waiting for it all to be over. But genuine patience is not waiting. It's a letting go of wait. It's a letting go of time altogether. That you're not waiting for it to be over. There's a total surrender to it being exactly like this. You're not wanting it to be any other way. You're not waiting for it to be over. There's a total openness to this moment, even though it might be uncomfortable or difficult or painful. There's no imagining that it could be different, or there's no maneuvering to get to some other place, or no wishing for it all to be over. There's a complete relinquishment of that within the heart, a relinquishment of resentment, of negativity, of time. So true patience, that which counteracts restlessness, is a brightness of the heart. It's an opening. It's not a clamping down or a freezing, a limitation. So I'd like to emphasize this, because we don't really have a way of framing that in English, but it's such a there's such a difference in the attitude towards one kind of patience, just grimly waiting for the painful to pass and basically resenting what's there, and that quality of letting go, the quality of genuine abandonment, of not struggling against the way things are, but being totally open to the way things are. And in that openness, there's a great freedom, even though that painful or difficult condition is still present. There's no resentment in the heart, no negativity. The classic tale that's told in the Jataka stories of this is where, in a previous life, the Bodhisattva was a yogi, and he dedicated that lifetime to developing patience. And he was off living in this cave in the forest. And one day a king and his courtiers and the harem came out to have a day's hunting in the woods and picnic with the whole crowd, the whole court. So that as the story goes, the king and all the men folk go off hunting in the woods and leave all the women folk behind. So they get a bit fed up with waiting for all the men to well, they're off chasing the animals and being busy with the hunt. And so they sit around and chat for a while, and then they start to explore the area around this little glade where they've been having their picnic. And they sooner or later, one of them finds this cave, and in the cave they see this, what they think is some kind of a statue or an old shrine. And there's this sort of figure in there that's all covered in cobwebs and moss and bird's nests and such like. And then they look up close to sort of examine this rupa, or see what kind of a shrine or deity is being worshipped there. And then as they go up, and one of them starts to sort of pick off the cobwebs and the bird's nest, then they realize, oh my goodness, it's actually a person. There's somebody sitting here. It's a live person. And then they said, no, it's not. It's a statue. No, it's a person. It's a statue. It's a person. And then suddenly the Bodhisattva opens his eyes and says, yes, I'm a person. So they're all startled, and they go, oh, wow, you know, how could you possibly sit here for so long that the, the spiders would weave cobwebs over you, and the birds would build nests in your hair and in your lap. So, well, I'm a yogi, and I've dedicated this life to learning patience. They go, oh, that's incredible! How'd you do that? And so they all gather around and start asking questions, and so then the bodhisattva starts to give them various teachings. So then the king and the guys come back from their hunt, and then they find that all of the women folk have disappeared, and that all of the plates and dishes and food are there, but all of the queens and the court women have vanished. So they start hunting around, and lo and behold, they find them all in this cave, gathered around this yogi. So the king is a very impatient and restless, reactive character. Immediately whips out his sword and says, you know, who the hell do you think you are? What are you doing? You're trying to steal my women. How dare you? Who do you think you are? And he said, well, I'm not trying to steal your women. I'm just a yogi. I've been sitting in this cave for years and years. They just showed up and started to talk to me and ask questions. And so I was just being polite and answering their questions. That's all. But what do you think you're doing here? Why do you sit here? You know, you say you've been here all these years. How do I know you're just not, you know, someone who's put himself in this cave, covered yourself with stuff to just lure, you know, innocent and virtuous people, you know, lure my women and others to be drawn into your own unscrupulous plots and plans and your own fulfill your own desires. You know, how do I know that you're telling me the truth? And he said, well, I've been here all these years, and what I'm here to do is, I'm not here to seduce anybody or to plot anything or to get anything from anyone. I'm here to practice patience. That's what I'm determined to do, and I've been here all this time, just sitting in this cave, meditating, trying to practice patience, and learning to deal with physical discomfort and the deprivations of hunger and so on and so forth. So the king says, patient? You're trying to be patient? Well, let's see how patient you can be with this. And then he whips out his sword and then slices off his nose and also his ears and says, so how patient are you with that? And he says, oh, I'm very patient. Fine, no problem. And then the king says, okay, well, see how patient you can be with this. And then he slices off his lips and then cuts off his left hand and his right hand. And said, okay, so how patient can you be with that? If you're really being patient, then there won't be any bother to you. But if you're a fraud, then you're going to get angry. He says, I'm not getting angry. You know that you coming here and treating me like this is just part of what I'm ready to learn from. And I'm not angry. I'm not upset. And the king says, how can you not be angry? I've cut off your nose and your ears and your lips and cut off your hands. And you know, there's no way that someone could experience that and not get angry, not get upset. What about this then? And gives him another couple of slices and takes his legs off. So then, by this time, here he is sitting with his arms and legs all chopped off, his nose and his ears, lips all sliced off, bleeding heavily. And then the king is beginning to experience a feeling of doubt, which I'll get onto in a minute. So he says, well, he's either an extremely good actor, or maybe I've made a terrible mistake here, and actually this was a genuine yogi who was trying to practice patience, and I've been too quick off the mark to attack him or punish him, and maybe I'm really in trouble here. And then at that moment, you know, the heavens thunder and the earth quakes, and he realizes, oops, the gods are angry. You know, I'm really going to get into trouble here. And so that then he has this moment, this sudden realization of, I've made a terrible mistake. And so then he kneels down and says, oh, please forgive me. I realize that I've been a fool. I've been angry and reactive and proud and presumptuous. And really, you are obviously a very fine and accomplished yogi, and I've made a terrible mistake. That it's been an awful error, and I know I'm going to be punished in a miserable state for eons and eons because of harming you and causing you such difficulty. And so that the And you know, all this effort that I've made to try and cause you to be angry, you know, that it's going to cause terrible bad karma on my part and misery and pain for you, and I'm sure it's tested you to your limit. And he said, well, no, I'm fine. You know, really, you haven't tested me to my limit. This has been a good opportunity. And to prove that you haven't roused any anger in me, if I have experienced any anger whatsoever, any negativity, may I bleed to death right here. But if it's the case that you've just helped me to cultivate patience and there's no anger has arisen in my heart, then may all my limbs reassemble themselves and may my life carry on. And at that moment, you know, all the arms and legs kind of reassemble themselves, his ears come back on the side of his head and his nose comes back into place. And then the king, immediately seeing this extraordinary, miraculous event, starts bowing vigorously and says, oh, you know, obviously you are a great and powerful yogi, and I really screwed up and I've made a terrible mistake, and I'm bound to have some kind of miserable existence down in the hell realms for incalculable eons. And so I'm terribly sorry, you know. And so then the bodhisattva says, look, there's really no need for you to apologize. You've helped me to, you've given me causes to help fulfill my vows and fulfill my practices. So really, you've been doing me some great favors. And to prove that, you know, not only have I got no resentment towards you, no negativity, to affirm that to the highest degree, I will guarantee that, you know, because I'm here practicing in order to achieve Buddhahood in the future, when I become a Buddha, then you will be the first person that I teach, and I will commit myself, you know, here and now to helping you to be the first person that I carry across to enlightenment, you know, after I reach Buddhahood and am able to teach others the way to enlightenment. And so then, as it said in that story, then this is the northern Buddhist version of the story. It's said that king, the king of Kalinga, became Anya Kundanya in the Buddha's lifetime, when he was in the deer park with the five disciples. And Anya Kundanya was the one who first had the insight into the Four Noble Truths, when the Buddha taught that, gave the first teaching of the middle way and the Four Noble Truths in the deer park in Isipatana. Anya Kundanya was the first one who understood. So that not only was he giving the opportunity for the bodhisattva to practice patience, but then he fulfilled that vow, and he was the first one that he carried across or helped to enter the stream and to guarantee his enlightenment. So we might think, well, that's all very well. This is a very fanciful legend. But in a way, that we tell these stories because they stick in the mind, and that when you take that, say, embodiment of patience and readiness not to react or to dwell in negativity or to get away from an uncomfortable situation, then it's pointing to, or it highlights how easily we we just move away from an ache in our knee, or we want to get away from having to deal with a difficult conversation or a burdensome responsibility that we just are fed up with, we want to get out of, we want to get away from. And so that these images, these perceptions that can be brought to mind and say, well, you know, the bodhisattva was happy to sit there and have his arms and legs chopped off without reacting. So how I can probably stand being in this meeting for another half an hour. I can probably deal with this ache in my back for another couple of minutes. I can probably deal with having to wade through the rest of these emails, or to cope with having to share a room with this difficult person, or to endure this long Dhamma talk. I can bear it. And not bearing by gritting the teeth, but bearing by letting go of the concept of the future, letting go of time and surrendering to the reality of the here and now. So the other hindrances there's of doubt and dullness. Probably if I went into those in detail, it would be testing people's patience even more. But these are, in short, the experience of dullness, when the mind drifts towards negativity, towards the switching off, the dealing with dukkha by just turning turning the sensitivity down, we just go numb, the mind switches off. The experience of the mind going dull and falling asleep, that gives us the opportunity to develop brightness, to learn how to rouse energy, to cultivate the virya paramita. And this is extraordinarily important. If you look at the lists of spiritual qualities, in virya, energy is one of the 10 paramitas, it's one of the 5 spiritual faculties. The samma vayamo, right effort, is part of the Eightfold Path. Virya is also one of the 7 factors of enlightenment. It's essential, it's crucial to the all spiritual development. It depends on virya. So rather than thinking I've got a terrible problem with dullness, my mind's always falling asleep, and that, see that if that is the habit, the mind numbing out, to develop the skill of rousing energy, to see the mind moving towards dullness, towards heaviness, towards switching off, then it causes us to learn how to rouse energy, how to bring energy up through the body to brighten the mind, so that we can see that's a tremendously valuable skill. And then the habit of the mind of going into doubt, burning endless amounts of energy, trying to figure everything out, or thinking our way to the conclusion of a particular issue or question. That this habit or problem, the capacity of the mind to get caught in endless doubting and thinking, it teaches us about papancha, about conceptual proliferation, about distracted thought, how that works. When we really look at the doubting mind, it teaches us how thinking works, how the mind takes a simple perception, a feeling, a memory, and whoosh, you know, off it goes. It takes a simple perception or assessment of some particular situation, and then takes it and runs with it and turns it into an endlessly tortuous problem. We get lost in that forest of thinking. So rather than bemoaning the mind getting caught in doubt and endless questioning and getting lost in the thickets of questioning and doubt, to see that, well, this teaches us about how papancha works, how conceptual proliferation works, and the more we understand that, and also how we can counteract that, what are the things that we can do to counteract that tendency, then we learn the mechanics of distraction, how the mind gets pulled apart. So just like with dealing with sense desire teaches us how to use reflective thought, similarly doubt teaches us how thinking works and how to compose the mind, how to bring the mind to a quality of coherence, of cohesion, of integration rather than distraction. Now, the one particular little teaching that the Buddha gave that I'll finish with was where he brought many of these things together is what's called the Meghya Sutta, which probably many of you are familiar with, where the Meghya was supposed to be the Buddha's attendant, but he was so inspired by the teachings, he said, I want to go off and meditate by myself in the forest, and you know, I can't, Venerable Sir, I'm sorry, I can't look after your needs today, I have to go off to the woods, I'm determined to go off and practice by myself and awaken to the Dhamma. And the Buddha said, Meghya, this is not a suitable thing to do, it's not a good idea, it's better if you stay with me. And as they always do in these stories, they go back and forth 3 times, and Meghya insists he wants to go off into the mango grove and meditate by himself in order to arrive at enlightenment. And so the Buddha says eventually, okay, well, I can't stand in your way, you've asked this 3 times, and you know, I've told you how I see things, so okay, off you go. At the end of the day, Meghya drags himself back saying, oh, it's incredible, it's amazing. My mind all day long was completely consumed with unwholesome and destructive, distracted thinking and thoughts of sense desire and ill will and cruelty and the whole morass of difficulty. So then the Buddha is very compassionate, as you'd expect, and then says, you know, when the mind's capacity is still unripe, then this is what you can expect, Meghya. But you should, to counteract ill will, it's you should develop loving kindness. To counteract sense desire, you should cultivate the perception of asubha, of the unbeautiful. To counteract distracted thought, develop mindfulness of breathing. To train the attention to focus on the breath. Then to develop, to counteract or to see through the illusions of identity. It's good to develop the anicca sanya, the perception of impermanence. And he says, for to develop the perception of impermanence helps us to see through the delusion of the conceit of I am, asmimana. When we see that all things are impermanent, this helps us to pierce the illusion, the delusion of individual personal existence, the conceit of identity. And then he says, well, when the heart is free of asmimana, of the conceit of identity, that is nibbana here and now. So when that delusion of identity, the conceit of I am, is seen through, when that's recognized as a transparent, illusory perception, then that is nibbana here and now. So just in that one package, in that one short sutta, the Buddha puts all these together, and this is a very helpful little synopsis. So to practice loving kindness, to dispel ill will, to practice asubha, the reflections on the unbeautiful, to counteract sense desire, to cultivate mindfulness of breathing, to counteract distracted thought, and to cultivate anicca sanya, the perception of impermanence, of uncertainty, in order to counteract asmimana. And when those are all fulfilled, when those are taken to their completion, then that delusion, the perception of I am, the conceit of identity, is seen through. And when that's really dissolved, when the conceit of I am is let go of, then this is nibbana here and now. There's the great peace of nibbana. The heart's true release, the heart's true contentment, it's here. It's right here when those patterns or perceptions of I and me and mine are seen through. So these are some thoughts to reflect on for this evening. And whatever is useful, please take it and use it. Whatever is not, please leave it aside. But this is just an encouragement to see that whatever hindrances we have inside ourselves or outside ourselves, these are actually treasures. Like these are the sweet adversities. Sweet are the uses of adversity. But these adversities are really teachers for us. They are blessings that, when we put them to use in a good way, that are the very means whereby we liberate the heart. Amen. Well, as usual, this is the observance day, so that the pattern of things is that we will carry on the vigil until midnight and then formally close the evening then. So those of you who are able to stay and join in with that, doing sitting, walking meditation, then please do so. Those of you who need to return to your nests, do other things, then please feel most welcome to do that too.